Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing the new Octavia Spencer vehicle, Ma. I think that holds the record for shortest title of any film we've ever reviewed. I think it would have to, unless, yeah. I don't know, we go and watch, I don't know, M or something.
We use the word vehicle advisedly, too. There's a lot of... vehicular business in this movie, which you already know if you've seen the trailer.
So, the basic premise is that Octavia Spencer plays Sue Ann, also known as Ma, who is this middle-aged woman who basically starts buying these teenagers booze at the local liquor store, and everything kind of spirals from there, I guess. And there's a lot of backstory, a lot of baggage, and we'll get into all of that in our synopsis.
Mm-hmm. So, the movie opens with Erica and Maggie, mother and daughter, are moving into a new town, middle of nowhere, kind of out in the sticks. The whole moving in montage is set to this very, like, arcade fiery kind of, like, indie rock track. It's the whole thing just looks like a car insurance commercial, you know? And they're getting settled in. She's getting acquainted with friends at school. You're kind of expecting... the obligatory fresh fish, like school bullying moment, but it just never materializes. They're all just super chill.
It's also kind of weird because there's a lot of shots of Maggie kind of standing off by herself, looking at people. There's one shot where she's up above the lunchroom, staring down, and you kind of expect with that sort of weird behavior that she's going to get bullied the hell out of her, and no, not so much.
Oh, yeah, she's not a misfit at all. Turns out she hits it off with some hip, young, attractive people. They invite her to go to a party with them, which she does, but then the party is called off because so-and-so's mom is a real a-hole, you know, or however kids cuss at each other these days, and she just ends up hanging out with them in their vape van. Just, it's, I don't know, made me feel very old.
Yeah, I think my favorite line from this scene is when Haley, who's kind of the...
new BFF.
Yeah, and kind of your standard blonde party girl archetype, tells Maggie that, oh yeah, you can smoke until you're 25, and then if you stop then, nothing bad will happen to you.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think that's quite how lung cancer works.
Extends the pen in her direction and says, it's cotton candy flavored, which, you know.
Although I suppose it is fair to point out that if they're vaping, lung cancer isn't even really a consideration anyway.
Exactly. Well, this is we're out of our depth here. This is, you know, this Gen Z bullshit. I can't be expected to... So anyway, they start hey-mistering a bunch of strangers outside this liquor store, trying to get them to buy booze for them. They have, like, a fat stack of money. They're buying, like, enough booze for winter, it seems like to me. Like, they look like they're prepping for the apocalypse.
Gen Z goes hard, man.
Yeah, I
guess.
Not in the tobacco department, but in the alcohol department. Yeah, they're keeping the dream alive. So... nothing comes of this. They're rebuffed time and time again until Octavia Spencer comes by walking a dog, and she also gives them the cold shoulder initially until she sees the insignia on the side of the vape van that they've been hanging out in, which belongs to one of their fathers. Kid's name is Andy. Dad's name is
Ben.
Ben, yeah, and he owns Hawkins. Some kind of security outfit.
Yeah, it's a security business. You know, home and business security, and mm-hmm. He's got, you know, a fleet of trucks, vans, and this looks to be like kind of an old decommissioned one,
right?
That he basically gave his son for his car.
Ma appears to recognize the name on the side of the van, and she changes her tune real quick and buys them as much booze as they could ever dream of, and sends them on their way. We then get the first of many Ma creepin' moments where she's at work. She's like a veterinarian or like a veterinarian's assistant.
Yeah, assistant, I think.
I mean, she's definitely pretty low on the pecking order because she's constantly being harangued by Allison Janney, of all people.
whose sole role in this film is to be a shitty, obnoxious boss to
right.
Octavia Spencer. She only appears in the vet's office, and she's always yelling at Octavia Spencer to get off her phone or to do her job.
I don't know. I felt for Allison Janney, frankly, because if you imagine what it must be like to work with a fledgling psycho murderer who's constantly getting a 1,000-yard stare and not answering the goddamn phones because they're just thinking about, you know, all of the carnage they're going to unleash on the world. Then, yeah, I mean, it's she might have been a perfectly nice lady at one point. Unlikely, because she's being played by Allison Janney, who seems to be gunning for another I, Tonya Oscar, you know, playing another kind of miserable old shrew. Hard case. So Ma is on her phone, as she always is when she's supposedly working, and she's creeping on these teens that she just met, and she fucking narcs on them.
She narcs on them by calling Andy's dad.
That's
first.
Right. That's right.
And Andy's dad is in the middle of getting a rather enthusiastic blowjob from Mercedes.
Whoever did the Foley work was very enthusiastic. It's unmistakably it's not glamorous.
No, not particularly. It's in a motor vehicle.
Yeah.
But anyway, Ben, Andy's dad, then proceeds to sick the cops on them. They're out at the rock pile, which is what passes for a local hangout in where the fuck they are.
Yeah, bumfuck nowhere.
And they're drinking and smoking weed and doing whatever. And then the cops show up, and looks like the cops gonna come down hard on them. And then he goes over to Andy and is like, your dad called me. Played high school football with your dad. He was a dick. So he's like, I'm going to come back in 10 minutes. None of your stuff better be here when I get back. Mm-hmm. And so cop lets him off the hook. Yeah,
pretty much a best case scenario for that kind of incident. I don't mean to harp on about the BJ scene. I really would like to move on. I only want to stress what makes it weird and why I was kind of hung up on it is that this is the first time we're meeting Andy's dad or the woman who's going to town on him. So it's a weird introductory shot, I think, is the reason that I kind of stumbled over it. And they end up playing a not insignificant role in the movie. So
it's the kind of introductory shot you would expect from, I don't know, fucking Boogie Nights or something.
Yeah, right. So the kids scatter. And so sometime later, they are getting liquor from Ma again. I think this is only the second time that this has happened,
yes.
Although they've gotten very chummy with her. And she says, whoa, 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 Andy or somebody tries to hand her the money. And she says, not here. I got eyes on me. They treat it like a fucking spy thriller all of a sudden. Although, you know, she has ulterior motives for luring them to a more secluded locale. She says, right this way. You know, I don't want to lose my job. Follow my car. And she leads them back to her house and says, kids, you know, I worry about you driving drunk and so on. I've got a basement here. Why don't you come downstairs? You know, we'll have ourselves a party. And this whole movie might not have happened were it not for the fact that Haley's defining characteristic is that her bladder acts up at the most inopportune times. It gets them into trouble more than once. And she's like, guys, I really got to pee. Let's just go in. So they do. And it's kind of a rundown
murder basement.
I mean, you know, it's a basement. What are you going to, it's not furnished, I guess, or just barely furnished. It looks like it's used for storage mostly, a little cobwebby, but they're having an okay time. They're drinking, carrying on. And one of them, Chaz, real obnoxious shithead, starts picking a fight with Ma for some reason. He gets real like uppity all of a sudden. And I don't remember why. I remember thinking that it came a little out of the blue, so it's possible there wasn't a legitimate reason, but
he's just giving her a lot of sass, and then
and like this woman just made them pizza rolls, like, and he's like, it's something, he's daring her to do something, and then he's like, oh, it's okay, unless, you know, I guess you just don't want to be cool or something like that. And it looks like maybe he's saying it as kind of a put on, cuz it's such PSA after school special kind of dialogue. It's such phoned in kind of peer pressure jargon but she takes it very seriously, grabs a handgun, and makes him perform a striptease at gunpoint.
Well, I wouldn't call it a striptease. She just makes him take off his clothes.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's not really putting his heart into it. I don't mean to give that impression.
She makes him take off all his clothes, and then after this presumably underage youth has made himself nude in front of her. She just starts laughing and like, haha, got you. And everybody's like, oh, whoa, you definitely got us.
Yeah, it's weird because like there's ominous music playing and then the music stops. And it's like her laugh is supposed to be this tension breaker because everyone is like relief just floods over all of them, including Chaz, who's like sheepishly putting his clothes back on. But it's one of those, you know, funny how, like a clown, do I amuse you kind of scenes. Except she's actually waving a gun around and, like, making him publicly humiliate himself. So why they ever go back to Ma's basement is completely beyond me. This is a complaint of mine that's going to recur later on. It's like, there's nothing she can do to these kids that's going to scare them away. They're like, I don't know, like moths to a flame. It's ridiculous.
Kids want to drink, man.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, that's a hell of a siren song, I guess. So this is when we get the first of many flashbacks to Ma's high school experience. It's now becoming apparent to the audience, although not to the kids, that Ma knew a bunch of their parents and went to high school with a bunch of their parents. She was a little bit of an outcast, and there's a steady drip feed of these flashbacks as we get through the movie. More of this is cemented in a scene where we see Maggie's mother, what was her name, Erica, at work. She works at a casino. She's carrying around trays of booze to the gamblers, and she runs into some people that she recognizes. This is when it becomes apparent that they're not just moving to the middle of nowhere, they're moving back from the big city to the town where Erica grew up. So it's a little bit of a fall from grace for her. She runs into Andy's dad and the lady who was blowing him, whose name is Mercedes. And Mercedes is sloppy drunk, kind of does everything sloppy, it appears, and she it's crass. I apologize to all six of our listeners. That was beneath me. She kind of gets shitty and is like chewing out Erica for it's like, wow, you moved away and then you had to come back. That's so sad. And
it's like, you never fucking moved away at all.
Yeah, not as sad as never leaving. So I tell myself, maybe just hit a little too close to home. Anyway, that's enough autobiographical flavor, I think. We then get another party at Ma's house. It's become just the hottest spot that there is. A whole bunch of teens have descended on the place in a fucking drunken feeding frenzy. Ma is blasting Funky Town. All of her, like, DJ decisions in this movie are decidedly... Like, what is she? She plays Funky Town. She plays Kung Fu Fighting. She plays that fucking, is it Safety Dance? Is
basically,
that the name of it?
I mean, with the exception of Kung Fu Fighting, which I think is a little older, but it's mostly stuff that she would have been listening to in high school.
Right, although I have a hard time imagining that Safety Dance was cool even back then. I mean, I know it was a hit, but in any case, at this party, it may be a different party. The movie's timeline gets a little hazy for me around this point. Ma is goaded into doing shots. She collapses under the peer pressure. It doesn't put up much of a fight, but she insists that she doesn't drink. They all start chanting, Ma, Ma, Ma. Incidentally, she acquired this nickname. It comes up, I think, kind of inorganically. I may or may not complain about this at a later date. When they ask for pizza rolls the first time they're in their basement, one of the kids, his name is Darrell, says, you got any bagel bites, Ma, or something like that? And
I think
like,
he says pizza rolls, but yeah.
Yeah. And she says, Ma, I like that. And then it just catches on. So they're all chanting, Ma, Ma, Ma. She does the shot. Everyone goes straight to Funky Town, having a grand old time. And the only reason that any of this is worth mentioning is because you hear clattering from upstairs. And Ma says, like, oh, that busted old ice machine. Let me go check on it. No one in the audience buys that explanation, needless to say. She goes upstairs.
And neither does Maggie, for that matter.
Yeah, Maggie's faster on the uptake than any of her friends.
Although she still doesn't like... Well, we'll get into it. So she's wondering what's going on upstairs. Meanwhile, Haley, once again, bladder doing her in. She desperately has to pee.
Her poor bladder control is the real antagonist of this motion picture.
And the bathroom in the basement is... occupied supposedly by some boning teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
So even though Ma has expressly forbidden them from going into the rest of the house, Haley and Maggie are going to sneak upstairs to find another bathroom. that's when they get up there and Maggie hears Ma saying some rather ominous stuff to someone we can't see.
Yeah, we hear some kind of stock, like, punching or slapping noises. Sounds like someone tenderizing a steak. Somebody is getting brutalized upstairs. Maggie hears this. Haley doesn't. Maggie ducks into the bathroom, interrupts Haley while she's doing her business, and says, "We got to get out of here." As they leave the bathroom, they are jump scared by Ma, who attacks them.
Yeah, slams them against the wall.
Mm-hmm. And they hightail it out of there. So the following day, Haley at least claims to not really remember what happened, blackout drunk. Maggie is much more perturbed. They're all kind of like ambushed outside school by Ma, who's like, "I don't care that it's a weeknight. Let's get wasted." And they're all like, "Oh, nah, Ma, we got homework to do." Everyone's kind of cooling off on the whole Ma situation right now. There's another party where this is what I'm talking about. Like, it seems at one moment like they're all not drinking the Ma Kool-Aid anymore. And then the next thing you know, they're back in her basement partying. Booze, man, what are you going to do? Being underage is a hell of a predicament. So Ma roofies Maggie, and then Maggie wakes up and her earrings are missing. And she's alarmed by this. You know,
she wakes up at home, it should be made clear.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, no, she does. Yeah, she doesn't wake up at Ma's place. But yeah, no, Ma, she slips something into Maggie's drink because Maggie and Andy have started going out. I always feel like such a jackass when I start recounting fictional high school drama in these fucking movie reviews. But, you know, slasher movies are about teenagers. Teenagers have teenager problems. What are you going to do? So Ma has really taken a shine to Andy and is getting kind of territorial, I think, is what we're meant to infer from that whole incident.
There's lots of jokes made about that, and then we, through more of these flashback scenes, we get the impression that Ma, who was in high school, kind of a shrinking violet.
A little bit of a wallflower.
Ben, Andy's father, would kind of like be nice to her from time to time and gently flirt with her, but he also clearly like didn't give a shit. It was one of those situations. But she, of course, kind of fell head over heels for him. And so this is kind of a transference thing more than anything else.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Ma roofies Maggie, and then Maggie wakes up at home in her bed, doesn't know what happened. She and Andy like go to the mall together, and Andy's like telling her what happened and kind of gaslights her for a hot second as a joke, like, "Oh yeah, you flashed Chaz your tits. JK, never mind." And that's
boyfriend of the year.
Right. And that's when Maggie says, "Okay, promise me you're not gonna go back to Ma's ever again, no matter what." And first he says why, and she just kind of stares at him, and then he's like, "Yeah, okay, that's fine."
Right, so then Haley initiates this, like, so Ma gets canceled, basically, in the parlance of our times. Haley sends out this mass Snapchat or something, or an Instagram video, saying, like, "All
TikTok,
right, everybody,
who the fuck knows?
Yeah, block Ma, because Ma has been blowing up everybody's phone, apologizing, or at least not everyone, but Maggie and Haley, for sure, apologizing in like this 40 plus text chain.
Yeah,
come back. I never meant to hurt you. So on and so forth. So Haley sends this video saying, "All right, everybody, time to block Ma," to everyone, including Ma, who assesses the situation, decides she needs to do some damage control, and then calls an emergency rock pile meeting,
which they attend.
Right, because she sends them a tearful like FaceTime or something, being like,
"Guys, it's an emergency. I gotta talk to you." And I even considering that, I mean, obviously it was a mistake, but like I think it should have been clear to them at that point that it was a mistake. Nevertheless, they go to the rock pile and they meet her, and she tells them, and she lies to them, that she has pancreatic cancer, and she's been taking a lot of meds, and they mess with her mood, and she's not herself.
They've been making her loopy, supposedly. So most of them seem to buy this. It's weird, you know, as always, I have a hard time gauging where they're at vis-a-vis pro or anti-Ma. It seems like they're very fickle, these teenagers. I guess, you know, you need something to do on the weekend. But one of them, I believe it's Haley, notices that Ma is wearing a bracelet that does not belong to her. In fact, belongs to a girl who just had a birthday party in Ma's basement the previous weekend.
That was the party where the roofing happened.
Yes. So between Maggie's missing earrings and this other chick's bracelet being on Ma's wrist. And
Haley's missing a ring.
Yeah, a bunch of them are missing jewelry. So Haley and Maggie decide to go on a jewelry heist, basically. They go to Ma's house in the middle of the day when she's working at the vet, supposedly. And they're poking around upstairs. They find a bunch of creepy memorabilia, high school yearbooks that have been cut up into collages and pictures of their own faces plastered all over Ma's mirror, things of that ilk.
And this is when we meet, and not for the first time, I'll explain in a moment, but this is when we meet Jeannie, who is Ma's daughter. We met her very briefly earlier on in the film when...
Back when it still looked like Maggie was prime bullying material.
Right.
It's like her first day of school.
It's her first day of school, and Jeannie, who is wheelchair bound in a motorized, you know, electric wheelchair that apparently has run down, so she's kind of like stuck in the hallway and can't move. Maggie helps her. And then we don't see her again until this scene where we find out that, hey, this is Ma's daughter. Also, she's walking around.
Yeah.
And we find out some rather disturbing things. Basically, it seems like...
Well, to even get onto the top floor of the house, they had to unlock a wooden gate at the top of the stairs that was, you know, latches from the outside. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's clear that her daughter is being kept in captivity, hasn't been showing up to school.
And not only that, but it appears that Ma is keeping her sick.
Mm-hmm. With veterinary supplies, like tranquilizers.
Yeah, giving her a lot of drugs and making her weak. And Jeannie realizes that all is not right, but she's not desperately trying to flee. It's kind of she's in a middle ground, weirdly. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's Munchausen's by proxy will do a number on you psychologically. Yes, so
true.
They narrowly escape. Ma shows up earlier than expected. And Maggie and, what's her name, Haley. Book it. They get out of there in just the nick of time. Next scene of any consequence is Ma and Andy's dad, Ben, having a little bit of a meet cute at the vet. He shows up with his cat and is like, oh, he doesn't call her Ma. What's her name? Sue Ann. Oh, Sue Ann, is that you? Wow, I haven't seen you in, 10, 15 years? Again, they went to high school together. We should get a drink sometime, catch up. And Ma is still very smitten, and so she agrees. And they have their date night. They meet at a local bar. And at first, it seems like everything is hunky-dory, and then he springs his trap.
Yeah, he pulls out this tracking device and explains that he puts one of these in every one of the vehicles in his security fleet, including his son's van. And so he knows where his son has been, specifically at Ma's house, repeatedly and for long periods of time. And he very justifiably asks, what the fuck?
Mm-hmm.
Why is my son at your house? Stay away from him. If I find out that he's been at your house again, I'm not going to call the police. I'm going to handle it myself. So she's tries kind of limply to slow his roll, but he's not having it, and he storms out, slaps a 20 on the table, and leaves.
Right. We then get a scene where Maggie comes home. Her mother, Erica, is talking to someone in convivial tones in the living room. And Maggie realizes that it's Ma, and she has to do it. It's straight out of Fatal Attraction, where they both pretend to not know each other.
Yeah.
And that's about it, basically. They share a long, ominous hug. And it's around this time that we get the payoff to this flashback structure. This, as I said, steady drip feed of flashbacks that we've been getting. And we see a very upsetting incident wherein Sue Ann, Ma, young Ma, is...
She's lured into, an empty classroom or a janitor's closet and gotten to give a person who she thinks is Ben a blowjob.
Yeah, in a dark, unlit janitor's closet.
And this is apparently, there's a scene earlier where, this is her first time, which fits with kind of her behavior and the whole shrinking violet thing. So she gives this guy a blowjob, and it's kind of heartbreaking because they finish, And she gets up and she says, "Ben, are you going to talk to me tomorrow?" Jesus.
Yeah, they really rub a lot of salt in it. It's hard to watch. And they emerge, and it was just a prank, bro. Because there's like a hallway full of more high schoolers than I ever had in high school. I don't know how you corral that many people to watch a. Anyway, it's fucking crazy. Also, Erica, Maggie's mother, is implicated because she's the one who, I think, she gives Sue-Ann lip gloss or lipstick.
No,
or
that's
something.
Mercedes.
Was that Mercedes?
Yes.
Okay. Well, Erica's mother is present.
She's present. She could have stopped the prank. And
yeah,
she didn't,
right. Okay.
Which there's a little bit of payoff later.
So,
we find out that it wasn't even Ben.
Yeah, it wasn't Ben in the closet.
It was just some tall doofus with glasses. And Ben asks him, like, "Hey, man, how was it?" And he's just like, "Oh, it's great."
Right.
And everybody laughs. And it's fucking, it's one of the most heinous high school quote unquote pranks I think I've seen on film.
Yeah, and more on that later, because that is, there's reasons that I'm intrigued by that. But yeah, it doesn't make it any easier to sit through. So we then cut immediately from this. I feel like they had to structure it this way in order to kind of get you on Ma's side in that moment, because the next thing she does is she's driving away from the bar and she sees Mercedes jogging down the side of the road. And she swerves and mows her down and then starts blasting September by Earth, Wind, and Fire, which more than anything makes it feel like it's, I don't know, that like, oh, yeah. It's like that like succession of experiences. Our whole theater pretty much lost their shit at that. And I think it's the first indication of the direction that the movie is going to go in for the remainder of its runtime. I mean, that Mercedes getting got is kind of where this movie jumps the rails and never looks back. We then get a succession of scenes, a very rapid succession of scenes, in which Ma appears to be apparating around town, just wreaking havoc, because it happens very quickly. So Louie, who's Maggie's dog, is injured in the backyard, non-fatally, it seems, and Maggie looks out and sees Ma lurking in the shadows off in the distance. Maggie runs inside, says Louie's been hurt, and Ma says, "Oh no, I'll call Sue-Ann," you know, Sue-Ann the friendly vet. And Maggie says, "No, don't," and this is when some, but apparently not all, of the truth comes out, because Erica, the mother's takeaway, is, you damn kids getting drunk behind my back, not, oh, you've been hanging out with a dangerously unwell person. So Maggie gets grounded, and that's the end of that. We then see Ma at work, where, so all through the movie, I was a little bit uneasy, because as soon as it's established that this woman is a vet, you're just waiting for the first animal to bite the dust, and no one likes seeing dogs die. And so there's a shot of her. I thought she was getting ready to euthanize a bunch of the animals,
or at least euthanize Andy and Ben's cat. Maybe
that's kind of
what I thought.
Mm-hmm.
But no, she walks down this row of cages, and then at the end of it, there's a dead Allison Janney in a cage, just covered in blood.
Yeah, in a cramped little dog cage. So that was another kind of ooh moment. We had a very vocal audience this time around, and they basically, the movie didn't give them any rest from here until the credits rolled. It all escalates very, very quickly. Ben shows up to Ma's house and threatens her again because he thinks that his son is there. Then Ma produces the tracker from her pocket,
which we should have expected, because a couple scenes earlier, she's looking at WikiHow for how to remove a tracker from a car.
Yeah, every time it cuts back to the vet, Ma is just doing some sinister Googling. Like, every single time, she's added everybody on Facebook and what have you. Just scrolling past pictures or some kind of ominous WikiHow research. And then Ma gets Ben in the neck with a hypodermic needle, tranquilizes him. He wakes up chained to the bed upstairs with just a towel draped over his waist, otherwise buck-ass nude, hooked up to an IV drip.
It's a bag of blood, and it's got masking tape on it that says Louis. So he's getting a dog blood transfusion, which is, I mean, I don't want to say poetic, but it's a callback to earlier when Ma tells Maggie, be careful, go slow with Andy, because all men are dogs. Mm-hmm. They only want one thing.
Yeah.
And so she kind of reintroduces that language into this scene, saying, you did all this stuff to me, but I understand now. You were just treating me like a dog because you're a dog. So now I'm going to treat you like a dog. And yeah. She opens up the IV.
Yeah, she spends the rest of the movie torturing people. And there's always some flimsy pretense for why they're getting what they're getting. But they get the dog thing makes a degree of sense. But she always kind of waxes poetic for a second before she administers her idea of karmic justice. And some of them make more sense than others. So she, in addition to giving him a steady drip feed of dog blood, threatens to cut off his Johnson, and the scene goes full Bad Lieutenant for a second. I mean, you see her like cradling his junk.
There was one guy in the back of the theater who was particularly entertaining, and at this juncture he's like, oh no, ma no.
Okay, every once in a while he would just let out this high-pitched falsetto shriek. It's the that sounded like SpongeBob. It sounded exactly like, you know, a panicked SpongeBob would sound. And
apparently she heard him because she did not cut off Luke Evans's penis.
Yeah, just once the people on the screen listened to the audience, which I'm sure you know.
We broke reality.
Yeah, right, exactly. And then she proceeds to break Luke Evans. She cuts his other wrist, the arm that's not hooked up to the tube, and he proceeds to bleed out horribly. We then get one last party at Ma's place.
It's Chaz's birthday.
Yeah.
And so
one birthday is too many for Chaz.
At this point, Maggie is grounded, and she's in her bedroom looking at her phone and her laptop, and she gets a snap or whatever from Ma, who is like cuddled up with Andy in her basement. And then, you know, there's other kids there.
Flaunting Maggie's earrings to boot.
Yeah. And so Maggie takes her mother's car. Her mother's asleep at this point, and goes over to Ma's to yell at Andy for, like, you promised me you weren't going to come here. And he's all, well, you know, it's Chaz's birthday. Like, we had to come here. It's like, well, no. Yeah. So no,
him,
he didn't.
Him breaking his promise didn't surprise me. But then fucking Haley leans in. It's like, what? You know that she's torturing her daughter. What the fuck are you doing here? You started a whole Block Ma campaign for less than fucking Munchausen's by proxy. Like, do you really like Chaz that much? Like, is his birthday that meaningful to you? But anyway, the movie needs to get them all back in the basement one more time.
And everybody seems to now have been roofied like Maggie was the first time.
Yeah.
Everybody's getting kind of woozy. Haley is getting real, like, high school lesbian experimentation with Maggie before just kind of passing out. And Maggie kind of reads the writing on the wall. Everybody's passing out, and she tries to get away. And it's at this point that Ma has snuck out of the room and barred the, like, cellar doors directly to the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, now she's trapped everyone. Maggie gets the same hypodermic treatment that Ben did. And she wakes up, and they're all tied up with these, like, doom collars. They've got, like, spikes on the inside.
Yeah, kind of. For, like, really unruly dogs, I guess. Or dogs being subjected to some kind of conditioning. Yeah, they're all chained up in the basement. And Ma proceeds to, at this point, my list just devolves into iron, sewing needle, paint, 2 question marks, knife, gun. So I'll elucidate that for you, but these are all torture implements. That's the main thing I want you to take away from all this. So, and again, as I mentioned earlier, she starts monologuing a little bit about how, oh, Chaz has Chaz, the character who she forced to strip at gunpoint the first time they were in this basement. She partially disrobes him again. He's unconscious. Talks about how he has, like, a perfect ripped stomach or something like that.
And then proceeds to apply a hot iron to it.
Yeah, like a
clothing iron.
Iron. And yeah, she brands him. And he doesn't wake up. And then she talks about how Haley is always sassing people Always
the gift of gab.
Yeah, always mouthing off.
So she sews her mouth shut.
Mm-hmm. And then, most perplexingly, she starts talking to Darrell, who we hadn't mentioned is the kind of token black friend in the group. And she goes on this weird little diatribe about how it's like, oh, they...
There's only room for one of us.
Yeah, right. They, you know, they keep us around, but they don't really understand us, or we'll never really be one of them, or something like that. And then she paints his face with, like, white house paint.
Yeah. To be fair, Ma, Darrell, and Jeannie appear to be the only three black people in the movie and
enough.
In the town. So, you know, it doesn't come completely out of left field, but it is weird.
No, but it's also weird that she does the hot iron and then the sewing needle and then the paint. I know that it's racially charged, but it seems a little milquetoast after the first two.
Yeah, in terms of, you know, like, I mean, reversibility.
They'll all be traumatized, but I think, yeah, in the grand scheme of things, racial coding notwithstanding, Darrell gets off relatively easy. So then we get the payoff to a weird gag that the movie has been setting up for a while. There's a tertiary character who keeps showing up to these parties and immediately passing out, but not actually passing out. I mean, you'd think she was fucking narcoleptic or something, but apparently her parents are real Bible beaters or something.
Yeah,
and
her father's a pastor.
Right, yeah, that's what it is. And so she pretends to get wasted. She doesn't touch a drop, then pretends to have had too much and just pretends to sleep on the couch.
So she doesn't have to drink.
Right, but also so that she's not socially ostracized, so she can claim that she came to the party.
Right.
But it's a really weird gambit. I don't know if this is based on, like, something anecdotal from the screenwriter's own high school experience, but that's fucking pathological. I don't know anyone who would have done that. Maybe one or two parties, but not, like, multiple consecutive weekends.
Right.
So there's admittedly a pretty funny shot of this character who, again, has just been faking her unconsciousness the whole movie, waking up with a dog collar on. I say waking up. She was never out, which I guess means that she just lied there inert and consented to her collaring. That raises some questions.
It's not super clear, but yeah, it's
so
very possible.
She rouses herself while Ma's back is turned, and Maggie's just like, nah. Just like, just stand down. She lies back down and shuts her peepers again. And I thought that they were setting up some kind of Chekhov's gun thing here, where this weird character chronically faking unconsciousness was going to be the one who saves the day, which would have been kind of amusing. But no, she just makes a run for it and
gets
Ma
brained with the iron.
Yeah, so that's all there is there.
It's around this time that Andy starts to rouse himself.
Yes.
And rather than faking unconsciousness like the other girl was trying to do, he decides to try and sweet-talk Ma,
mm-hmm.
because he's been the kindest character, and he's the nice guy, and also he's the one she's got the crush on.
Yeah,
so.
Aside from the whole you flashed your titties at Chaz thing.
Yeah, I mean, nobody's perfect.
Yeah, nobody's perfect, I guess. No, I mean, we were all shitters in high school, I guess.
So he wakes up, and he's like, Ma? And then they have this kind of, like, hug thing, and he tries to trick her, saying, like, oh, I love you, and they kiss a little bit.
They start kissing, which, I have to say, elicited as many groans of unease and displeasure in our audience as the dog blood IV drip did, if not more. Everyone was like, ugh, oh, no! You know, it was a very vocal reaction, which I thought was... I mean, I get it, but, you know.
Proportionality.
Yeah, right, exactly.
But then Ma takes out a knife and is like, stab, liar. And so Andy goes down.
Mm-hmm. A cop shows up on the front door.
It's the cop from earlier, the cop who let them off.
Yeah, a cop who we have, on the basis of that interaction, have every reason to like and hope is going to be the cavalry in this situation. He starts questioning Ma. Hears a commotion from downstairs, goes for his gun. She shoots him first, and fatally. And then
first, it's Jeannie who makes the noise. Like, she comes in on her wheelchair, or
yeah,
that, or they make a noise downstairs, and then she shows
Jeannie
up.
Jeannie tries
and
to cover like for her mom.
Covers
yeah.
for her mom. But then, yeah, there's a scream, and that's when he turns back around, pulls his gun, but not before he gets capped.
Yeah, with this gun that is the same gun from the striptease scene. Ma had earlier claimed that it didn't even work, that it was like an antique. Obviously, it does work.
Yeah. and Ma forces Jeannie to help her drag the body inside and starts shouting at her like, "You made me do that," and all
yeah,
this stuff.
Right. She's the whole movie, or you know, as much as we see of her relationship with her daughter, she's always like, "No, you're not well." But the moment there's a dead cop on the porch, it's like, "Get out of that chair."
Right.
"Help me drag this body inside," you know, is what she forgets her daughter's alleged frailty awfully quickly. So then Ma goes back downstairs and is posing all of these unconscious, mutilated teenagers into a tableau with herself at as the centerpiece, and she wants Maggie to take their picture. Kind of a, you know, as we go on.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
She's like regressing back to this kind of high school mindset. Just me and my pals hanging out. Maggie takes a couple pictures, and there's screaming from upstairs. Jeannie, is that her name? The daughter? Jeannie starts screaming, "Ma, Ma, he's moving. He's not dead." Ma comes up the staircase, opens the door, wham, takes a frying pan to the face.
Which was the moment that I cheered.
Yeah, you weren't the only one.
Yeah.
It's, you know, and Ma falls over, knocks over a candle. Soon enough, the basement is ablaze. Jeannie hesitates for a moment, but then does the right thing and runs downstairs and starts untying everybody. Everyone comes to almost in perfect unison, which I thought was a little contrived.
A little bit weird.
And then they start banging on the cellar door. Erica and her coworker Stu, MVP, the unsung hero of this film.
We'll talk more about Stu after the break.
If Haley's bladder is the true villain, then Steve is the true, like, stealth hero of the piece.
Right.
Stu and Erica. Did I just call him Steve?
You did.
Stu, Steve, Stan, whatever. It's, you know, he's many things to many people. He's always there when you need him. He rescues them from the burning basement. Ma grabs her daughter and is about to throw her into the fire. There's a little bit of back and forth between Ma and Erica about how it's like, "You're weak. You should have stood up for me." And Erica's tearfully apologizing. Ma says to Maggie, "You're weak, just like your mother." And then Maggie grabs a knife and stabs her in the base of the spine. Says, "I'm not weak. I'm not my mother." And rescues Jeannie. Ma is now all alone in a burning house. All alone, that is, save for the corpse upstairs tied to the headboards.
And the dead cop.
And the dead cop, that's true. And then Ma walks upstairs through this conflagration and lies down next to Ben. And the movie pretty much ends. We get like a bird's eye view of the burning house. There's like kind of a shrieking cacophony on the soundtrack. It's like builds to this crescendo, cut to black.
And then it's the credits.
Roll credits.
So that was Ma in all of its splendor.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to go ahead and take our break, and then we'll be back with our thoughts in just a moment.
The bar is open.
What do you think?
We don't know this chick.
Ain't much, but it's all you.
Cool basement.
You're free to do whatever you want down here, but nobody go upstairs.
This is so sick.
Welcome to Moz.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break, to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at Shock Doctors Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/ShockDoctorsPod, or check us out on iTunes. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
Why's my son,
he smelled just like your daddy,
spending time at your house?
Hey guys, that bitch is crazy.
Probably something wrong with me.
And we are back. So, yeah, this was a movie. This was a movie we watched.
Yeah, that last 20 minutes is a real doozy. Like, as I said, it was weird because the whole time I was watching the movie, I was thinking like, oh, the marketing for this really kind of did it dirty. It's really more of a slow burn, psychological thriller, character study kind of thing. And then it goes full grindhouse almost at the last minute. Like, it panics and realizes it's almost out of time.
Like, and oh then, shit, this is a horror movie.
Yeah, and then the blood and guts start piling up remarkably quickly. And I was of two minds about that. I want to respect how buck wild it gets, but I'd be lying if I said it completely worked for me. I think that it's a little It's weird. It's like too much, too late. I know the expression is too little, too late, but in this case, it feels overcompensatory. I don't think that's a word.
Overcompensatory. We're gonna make that a word.
Yeah, sure.
It's overcompensating.
Yes.
Yeah. The first thing, and we've said this on maybe two or three episodes prior to this, but something that I kind of concluded after watching a good portion of this movie is, well, this isn't exactly a horror movie. It's not precisely on brand for us, because it really is more of just a psychological thriller. And even when the blood and guts start flying, it's still
relatively tame.
Yeah,
except for the dick shot. I mean, that's like a hard R.
It's tame in the horror sense. There's some buck wild stuff that happens.
Yes,
but it's not scary.
It's
crazy. It's wild.
It feels the last act, I mean, really it feels like less than a full act. The climax, I guess, feels engineered to get people's lips flapping more than anything. It feels engineered to prompt a lot of tweets being like, "Oh my god," or "Oh my god," as that really annoying trailer insists. Have you seen that one?
I haven't seen that
oh
one.
Ma.
No, I get it, okay, and that's it. Awful.
Do I have to? I can repeat it one more time.
No, thank you.
Yeah, it seems like it's supposed to generate buzz because it's like, wow, you won't believe that this. Because the movie is like this kind of weird Trojan horse in terms of how crazy the last 15-20 minutes are relative to everything that precede them. Although the trailer does give a certain amount of the game away. I mean, you see her run over somebody. I think there's even one trailer that shows a character's lips being sewn shut, although I think it elides their face.
Identity.
Yeah,
yeah.
Right.
No, I think that's true. I think
so. Yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, I don't know. It's a little all over the place, and I think that the first 80% of it, 80-85% of it, I kept thinking, well, this is clearly a script for a slow burn psychological thriller character study kind of thing that's been handed over to a little bit more of a hack horror director who doesn't know what to do with it. Because every once in a while there'll be a jump scare just to wake you up, you know, like when they run into Jeannie upstairs. When we realize that she and Ma are related, she's wearing like a spooky or would-be spooky tribal mask.
Yeah.
And, you know, just little kind of phoned-in jump scares like that. Loud scare chords on the soundtrack, obviously. I don't call it a jump scare anytime something startling happens. It's because the soundtrack goes into overdrive. You know what jump scares are. There's a lot of, like, what is it? When Ma gets their attention to give them their change the first time they hey mister her, she
slaps the passenger window.
Yeah, dun-dun! Really kind of just perfunctory, phoned in, like I said.
Yeah, the script, with the exception of the fact that it does kind of just go all over the place at the end and kind of off the rails, it's smarter than I would have expected.
In some ways,
like there's certain like dialogue touches littered throughout the movie that are surprising. Like Ma makes reference to dogs when talking to Maggie in front of her mother and things like that. Sure. I appreciated all
those.
Theme
established.
Yeah,
movie.
Right.
Well done. You planted that seed. It's not a lot, but it is by like kind of schlock horror standards. It is. Yeah. It's you can't take that sort of thing for granted.
Yeah, and there are other, again, it's mostly like little dialogue choices, and I can't really think of other ones because I wasn't taking notes like Matt was, because I'm a slacker. But yeah, there were things about it I appreciated, and I think overall I enjoyed this movie. Like the the fucking seeing the dog blood transfusion appear was, we were blindsided by that.
Yeah, I found that immensely disquieting. I wasn't here for that at all.
And I don't know that it qualifies as like a great movie making decision, but it certainly did get a reaction, and I enjoyed just how absurd it was.
Yeah, I mean,
in that moment,
these movies always need their Bunny Boyle moment, you know.
Right.
And that feels like the moment that's most calculated to like signal that she's gone full Fatal Attraction. That and her threatening to castrate the guy. Yeah, no, it just gets really The ending is just, it's diet Lars von Trier in a way that really doesn't sit right with me. I mean, I warmed up to the movie a little right at the end just because it does get so nuts. But even when it does, it feels like there's something missing or that it's not as hardcore as it could be, or the stuff that is hardcore about it hasn't been adequately prepared for. What I do like is that the pig's blood moment, the Carrie at the prom moment, this coercive, nauseating janitor closet blowjob is just so demented and so, like, it really, so there's a bit earlier in the movie where Erica, Maggie's mother, played by Juliette Lewis, is lounging on the couch feeling kind of sentimental, and she's doing a John Hughes marathon, and she asks Maggie if she wants to join her, and she says, I'm watching 16 Candles. No, she's watching Pretty in Pink.
Yeah.
I'm watching Pretty in Pink. Have you ever seen it? I, for what it's worth, have not seen Pretty in Pink. Is that the one with Long Duck Dong?
No, that's 16
Candles. That is 16 Candles. Okay, well, whatever. John Hughes movies have, in some of them, more than others, have not aged super duper well, and I think that her being Erica, kind of longing for the past or for like a sanitized version of her high school experience, is telling, and it's like the smartest thing in this movie, because then when you get the payoff of that awful prank that Sue-Ann is subjected to, it really feels like a refutation of the whole John Hughes mythos. The 80s were a crock of shit, which I'm like really on board with, because we've been living through this kind of like 80s nostalgia renaissance lately with both of the It movies and Stranger Things and Ready Player One and just a whole bunch of
just everything.
I'm just really burnt out on it. So it's nice to see, especially a horror movie, because horror has taken as a genre to this 80s pastiche moment that we're having with, I think, more enthusiasm than any other genre.
Yeah.
So to see a horror movie that's like, nah, the 80s sucked, it was like weirdly cathartic for me. So I liked that they impugn the whole John Hughes thing a little bit. I thought that was clever, just on the subject of this movie being a little shrewder than the average grindhouse horror flick. Although there are some ways in which I think it's not quite shrewd enough, or at least doesn't quite push it as far as it could. This is kind of what I was getting at when I said diet Lars von Trier, because it seems like there would inevitably be a racial undercurrent to Sue-Ann being singled out for this abuse when she's a teenager.
I was certainly expecting something like that.
Yeah, just one errant little, like, it's not even like I need to hear like a slur per se, but just like some acknowledgement that that's a facet of once she emerges from the closet and sees like that crowd of jeering white faces, it feels a little, I don't know. I just don't know why it isn't more overt than it is. I mean, it's still subtextual, I think. I just kind of wish it had been textual, because it would have given this movie a different layer. But obviously, it's, I mean, you know, no one likes feeling preached to, but I just feel like it would have given Ma's reign of terror at the end of the movie a little bit more of that righteous crusade kind of air that it seems like they were going for, but which I never really bought.
Didn't
with the exception of the aforementioned Earth, Wind, and Fire vehicular homicide, which did feel earned just because it follows right on the heels of the final flashback.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I think the flashbacks, you know what it reminded me of? Flatliners.
I wasn't going to bring it up, but I could not stop thinking about Flatliners.
Because
the original.
Yeah, the original. Because the original is like fun Joel Schumacher schlock, and the sequel is just 2010's horror remake vomit.
Yeah.
But so the original Flatliners, one of the plot threads is that Kevin Bacon's character, when he was younger, for those of you who don't know about Flatliners, basically, quick synopsis, med students are temporarily killing themselves, stopping their hearts so they can like experience life after death, or yes, whatever happens after death.
They are, and all meddling in God's domain.
And they all get like confronted with the bad shit they've done, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
yeah, it follows them back into the mortal realm. They start having these hallucinations of specters from the past, karmic retribution, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So Kevin Bacon is one of the, it's like a who's who of late 80s, early 90s stars. And Kevin Bacon's one of them. And his plot thread is that when he was a kid, and he wasn't the only one, but he was one of many kids who bullied this black girl at their school, who very kind of like dowdily dressed. And again, there's a lot of racial overtones to the whole thing, even if there's no like slurs or anything. And yeah, that was the first thing I thought of when I saw like young Sue Ann in the first flashback, because she's very much dressed the same. It's like, this is the 80s and she's wearing like 50s style, like a dress. Mm-hmm. When all the other students, all the other girls are dressed in the 80s get-ups.
She looks straight out of Flatliners, even though Flatliners came out, what, 30 years ago? It's like
almost.
90, right? It's
yeah,
like,
1990.
Yeah, right. So, and he's flashing back to not his high school, but his like elementary school experience or middle school at the oldest. So it's like, it's more period appropriate. But then when, yeah, young Sue Ann shows up looking like, I don't know, looking like, like the school's just been desegregated or something.
Right.
Like, and she's really like dressed like a relic. And everyone else is done up John Hughes style with the neon, like the kind of pastel colors and the frizzy hair.
Yeah.
So, but as in Ma, the bullying in Flatliners is not given that little extra push into like politics, I guess. I don't know if it's just because they don't want to go there or what, but like I watched Flatliners and thought like, you know, if they made this movie today, they would, it was, you know, whatever, it's the HW years, we're just not there yet as a culture. Fine, at least not in like a genre piece like this. But yeah, no, it was weird watching a movie in 2019 that was still walking on eggshells about that kind of thing. I also couldn't get Flatliners out of my head. It was the last movie I expected to think of when I bought my ticket today.
Yeah, and it would have, in addition to the fact that is the 80s, racism was everywhere, but also I get the sense that, you know, in addition to the fact that this town is just kind of like bumfuck nowhere and kind of out of the way, but I also got the vibe that it was kind of like not deep south but like middle south. Well, I know Ben has kind of a twang.
Yeah, Luke Evans is affecting a little bit of a twang, but he's kind of the only one. And I think he's just doing it because he's a Brit, is he not?
Yeah.
I mean, so I feel like that was more for his benefit.
It's possible.
He was trying to bury his own accent under an even heavier
but
one.
I think the other thing about it was there's a certain point where early on in the movie they're driving along this some kind of like major highway. And I don't remember the name of it now because it was just a passing thing. But I feel like it's a highway that I drove on when I was driving through like Tennessee mm-hmm. on my way home from California.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the fact that it may have been set in like the middle south makes it even more ripe for like, hey, look at this racism with all
yeah.
of these white kids,
yeah,
you know, pulling
right.
this heinous prank on this black girl.
Yeah.
And yeah, apparently we're still not going there in our genre films.
Well, this is an old horror trope of, you know, like the sins of the past coming. You know, this is what Freddy Krueger is about, right? He's like murdering the children of the people who burned him to death. And Flatliners is about this. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's Ma's revenge scheme in this movie it seems to have little to do with the parents, which kind of threw me. You know, I mean, she really does look like she's trying to, I don't know.
Like, she goes after Ben, obviously.
A little.
And
but
she,
Ben also kind of comes to her and, like,
well, yeah, but I think that's the point, because she stole the tracker.
Oh, yes. So, oh, yeah, well, yeah, by that point, she's just gunning for everybody. I mean, Allison Janney's already dead by that point.
Sure, but I feel like at least there's some payoff for it in that sense. Like,
yes.
She kills Ben. Obviously, she runs Mercedes over, but it doesn't seem, yeah, she's not really extending her revenge to everybody else. Like, mm-hmm. I guess because we don't see any other black people in the flashbacks, presumably Darrell's parents were not involved, but we don't see, like, Chaz doesn't appear to have parents. at least
maybe
not that
matter.
Maybe
that's why he's such an obnoxious little twat. No, my God, that's, yeah. He's more psychologically rich than I gave him credit for.
Haley doesn't have parents that appear to factor in. It's literally just Mercedes and Ben and then Erica.
Yes.
And so it's weird in that sense, sins of the parents redounding onto these kids, but like not all of the kids had parents who were apparently involved.
Well, yeah, and I think that's why her talking about Chaz's perfect beach bod before she brands him doesn't have any real weight. It's like he's just here because he wanted to get drunk. Same as everybody. Yeah, she singles all of them out for... There's even a line where when Haley is... Right before she starts kind of Frenching on Maggie, says something like, she's kicking out all the other kids. She just wants to hang out with the original crew tonight. Meaning the ones who originally hey-mistered her in the vape van outside the liquor
Which
store.
Which is funny because that apparently includes the girl who kept passing out.
Yeah, I guess she was too much trouble to move. But yeah, it's like, but why is she singling them out, though? Because as we've, you know, we're not going to beat a dead horse. But yeah, it just seems, her vengeance seems a little arbitrary.
Yeah.
And it so it doesn't have the impact that it could have. To say nothing of her weak rationale for why she inflicts specific tortures upon specific teens, which is kind of feels like the screenwriter was fumbling in the dark a little bit for some of them. But I complained about that already. A lot of the Ma going psycho stuff doesn't land quite the way it could. Like the Fatal Attraction scene where Maggie and Ma have to pretend they don't know each other in her mother's presence. It just doesn't have the oomph that I feel like it's, I don't know. It is a smarter than average movie in some ways, which makes the part where it comes up, the parts where it comes up short, all the more disappointing. I'll say this, the teenagers in this movie pretty much universally look like teenagers.
That's very true.
Which is nice to see.
I think that's becoming more and more true, typically.
Yeah. Well, we just watched Molly Hartley not long ago, which it was from some years ago.
From 10 years ago, where that was, yeah.
Yeah, not the case.
Yeah, 10 or 15 years ago, every, like, teenager horror movie, it's all a bunch of fucking 25-year-olds or worse.
Yeah.
I feel like the male lead from the Friday the 13th remake was nearly 30,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
so it's a trope that has definitely kind of improved.
Yeah,
but I don't want to let the episode wrap up without circling back to Stu,
of course. The man of the hour,
Erica's co-worker. When they get introduced to one another at the casino, he says, "My name is Stu," and somehow he turns the word Stu into like three syllables, which is just spectacular. It's like Stew.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know what point I'm trying to make. It's just, I feel like I need to tell all of you that.
I'm just saying that Stu makes a big splash. Like, him saying, "Hello, my name is Stu," is going to stick with me long after some of this movie's horror movie theatrics have faded from memory. It's an actor making a bold choice, and definitely pays off. I could have done with a lot more Stu, frankly. I was glad he was there.
At the end,
and I'm glad that he emerged from the movie unscathed.
Yeah, no, if they had killed Stu, I would have been pissed.
Yeah, good old Steve. Number one character, no doubt.
Yeah. Octavia Spencer's pretty good. She's very committed.
Yeah, I guess that's the note I would like to end on, is that her character has both more nuance than you would expect, but then also dramatically less. Once you realize, oh, this lady actually kind of has a lot going on, you know, not just in terms of her traumatic backstory, but just her interactions with people, her little tics and mannerisms. There's some meat on these bones, dramatically speaking, psychologically speaking. But then once your expectations have been raised to that point, the movie, I think, doesn't flesh her out any further. And I really feel like it comes down to the performance. Like, Octavia Spencer is game to really flesh this woman out. And I feel like the movie needs to meet her halfway, and it doesn't quite do that. It makes it like 30% of the way, and then she's got to do
a lot of like whack job heavy lifting.
Yes, and it's good whack job heavy lifting, but it could have been better. I think that she's a little underserved. I never quite shook off the feeling that she was slumming it, but if that's slumming it, then I don't know what Allison Janney is doing. That's like,
I mean, I was totally here for it, but yes, I was super confused when Allison Janney just cropped up out of nowhere in the first scene she appears, and
it's a thankless role. She just chews her out 3 or 4 times and then gets butchered.
Yeah, I was expecting her character to get bigger later to factor in somehow. I thought it was weird that I didn't know that Allison Janney was in this movie until I saw the movie.
I thought it wasn't her at first. I thought it was just a lookalike, and then it became unmistakable.
Yeah, and I don't know, like, maybe she did it as a favor to Octavia Spencer, because I think she also produced this movie.
Mm.
I don't know, but it was mystifying.
Yeah, it's hard to say, because Luke Evans is in this, Juliette Lewis is in this, and, you know, it's just, I don't know exactly what drew all of them to this project. I don't claim to understand it because it's, I don't know. It's an odd movie. It's a very, very odd movie.
Well, on that note,
yes,
this has been another episode of the Shock Doctors podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. We will see you next time.
As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Ma Trailer No. 1, 2019, Movie Clips Trailers, uploaded by Movie Clips Trailers. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, June 30th, and we'll be discussing the Jim Jarmusch zomcom, The Dead Don't Die. See you then.